I'll give a very brief introduction and then ask our panelists to give their observations on the votes are in, what happens now. So starting on my far left, the star of Jersey Street in Chicago, Lynn Sweet, Chicago Sun-Times. Lynn? Natasha Karecki with Politico, formerly with the Sun-Times. Greg Hines with Crane Chicago Business. And Darlene Glanton with the Chicago Tribune. Darlene, I don't know if you noticed, but Bruce Stold is sitting over there.
I think.
Okay. Who would like to begin? Since this was a national election as well as a state election, why don't we begin with Lynn?
Thank you, Ed, and thank you, everybody. And it's always good to be back here. And since I have not been back here, I just want to say I was just stricken when about the death of Paul Green, and I want to just convey that with his friends here at the City Club, my fellow Von Steuben alum here. So, Paul, I know you're with us today, or maybe you went somewhere else for lunch. So, the news out today, in case you haven't heard it yet, is that Senator Dick Durbin was reelected to his top leadership spot in the Senate, and he said he's not going to run for governor. So, who wants to run? So, I think that really now means that on the Democratic side, the race to find somebody who can run is on. And I know a lot of names have been mentioned, and I just think whatever the rules of so much have changed now with the election of Trump, with the ascent of Bernie Sanders, especially in Illinois. Now, Bernie Sanders, to speak nationally, came very close to beating Hillary Clinton in the primary. And we know from the WikiLeaks memos, stolen, that there was a lot of concern on the Hillary Clinton campaign about how strong Bernie Sanders was doing. So there's, I think when the Democrats look around in Illinois for someone to run for governor, the now very organized Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party that existed in the Chuy Garcia race, that consolidated further in the Bernie Sanders race, and that is out there now, is our voices to be heard in what otherwise for Democrats is a very difficult election, and right now for Donald Trump, a very different kind of transition from a candidate for whom the word normal is an understatement. But you have to respect that Donald Trump won the presidency. So the big national story is the drama surrounding his putting together an administration, the appointment of an incendiary top lieutenant, Steve Bannon, in the as a part of his top White House team. I was on a CNN show this morning, preceded by Jason Miller, who's one of his spokesmen, who basically said, and I thought this was a very telling quote, that they're not going to be confined by the media norms. And I would take him at his word. You know, Trump did it his way. He's been tweeting at least four times this morning, part of it in another snit at the New York Times. But everything that had been may not be. My brothers and sisters in Washington are very concerned that Trump doesn't have a pool of reporters with him all the time to record all his movements. I don't think that at all is a priority of the press operation of the Trump people. The seemingly chaos in the transition, having the Trump children a part of it, all this is such new territory, I don't know where it will lead. So in summary, since this will be a short opening, I think that you have an intersection of a state that has such a consolidated Democratic base in northern Illinois. We know from the election how Republican this state is in the rest of the area. We know that the collars have turned powder blue. In the context of a Republican House, Republican Senate, and a Republican White House, let me leave you with this thought. We are in very uncharted waters.
Thank you, Lynn.
And your last comment is a perfect segue to the person whose bailiwick really is our state of Illinois, Natasha Kurecki. Natasha?
Thank you, everyone. And for those who are not familiar, I do the Illinois playbook for Politico, so I am the one and only Politico presence in Illinois, and I cover everything from State House to anything basically politically involved that includes Illinois and or is of interest of Illinois. So Lynn laid out a pretty good groundwork there. I'll talk about a couple things quickly, and I know we're then going to get to lots of questions, and I'm sure you all have them. And I know we're going to spend some time about the media and what was the media's role. You know, are we the media elite? Did we lead the country astray because everyone was so wrong? A couple takeaways in that regard. I would say, in 2012 and in recent elections, we've had all this focus on polls, just very, you go to Real Clear Politics, the polls, and then what's the average of the polls. But I think what was a little different this time was not only the demand for these polls and this data so we can just, like, fill all this airtime, but was this, this probability of winning. And we kept hearing that over and over again, right? It wasn't that Hillary Clinton was up by 2 points or by 3 points. It was she had a 90% chance of winning. Some people were saying she had a 100% chance of winning. So, I think we need to ask questions now. What did that do to turnout? Particularly in your Wisconsins and your Michigans where, she didn't spend a lot of time. And so that is interesting. And, I spent some time last night with a DePaul researcher who was just talking about this constant demand for this data. You just end up getting a lot of junk polls because you cannot produce it. You cannot produce good polling quickly and just feeding the beast. The only one that was right actually was the LA Times tracking poll. But even then, I would say that the morning of the election, because I kept looking at that poll and saying, that is the only poll that has Trump up consistently nationally. But even when the morning of election day, the LA Times sent out their updated electoral map. They had Hillary Clinton with more than 300 electoral votes. And I was like, how do you even judge? That's with the same media organization. So there was a lot of that, and I'll just quickly shift to Illinois. So obviously, we are in a sea of red. There's been a lot of talk about that, and we remained blue. Hillary Clinton easily carried Illinois. Yes, Republicans expanded their map in this election. I think it remains to be seen whether that means we've gone more red in the South, or if that was, due to the Trump pickups. Because if you look at the 4 seats that Rauner won in the Illinois legislature, they were in pretty much Republican districts, I think maybe with the exception of one. You had McHenry County, Jack Franks. He decided not to run again. That's a Republican district. The reason he won is because he's Jack Franks. But they already knew that was going to go red, for instance. But, yes, I will say, Bruce Rauner has definitely changed the game in Illinois. He spent money that we've not seen by Republicans in our recent history, right, at the very least. And in an election year, in a presidential election year, usually Democrats are, Republicans are not on the offensive, and this time they were. They were fighting for every fighting, Bruce Rauner. they were fighting for every district. They held on to the McAuliffe, the only Republican state lawmaker. They held on, Republican state lawmaker in Chicago. They were able to hold on to that, and that was due to their organization and their money. And I thought one of the most telling things of last week was after, all of this money, there's been so much talk about all the money spent this election, was Bruce Rauner finally releases his income taxes on, Friday evening. Guess what? His first year as governor, not working anymore, he tripled his income to $188 million. So if you think that's not a sign to Mike Madigan, like, you thought that was bad, look what's up. Well, look what's coming. So I'll leave you with that. We could
thank
talk.
Thank you. Well, thank you. Well, speaking of business, Greg, the current president-elect, may have more business interests, domestic and international, than any other president we've ever had. But your observations, please.
Well, my observations are this is an election unlike any, I think, in any of our lifetimes we've seen. I hope to never see another one quite like it, to be perfectly honest. It was mean. It was dirty. It broke all the rules. It was uncivil. And all I can say is I'm sure I'm glad I'm not a pollster, because I'd have to go back and reinvent myself. But, you know, the people have spoken. God bless the people. Now we get into the more meaningful phase, which is, what does it mean? I think we're about to find out, we're in the process of finding out who Donald Trump really is and what he really believes in, because, frankly, we don't know. He got away with, and we in the media to a degree let him get away with, leaving a lot of ambiguity about where he was and all kinds of things. And his general approach, anyhow, is to be a big-picture corporate type and let somebody else work out the details. And I think you see some of that in how his transition team is rolling out, whether it's been there's little feuding duchies, there's the family, and there's the Christie people, and there's the Pence people, and the religious conservatives, and whatever. And where he's eventually going to come down, we don't know. I mean, indications are he's going to give a little hit here, take a little bit over there. Well, I'm going to appoint judges that overturn Roe v. Wade, but all gay marriage is settled. The courts have dealt with it. My suspicion is that he's going to present eventually the Democrats with some wonderful opportunities, because while he's going to shut down on free trade, which a lot of big companies in Chicago like, Boeing, Caterpillar, whatever, he's going to redo the tax code in such a way to make the 1% give him a big smile, because they're going to get big tax cuts. And that's going to present an opportunity to Democrats if they can use it. The problem with that, though, is we're about to find out who the Democrats are, because I don't think they know anymore. One of the shrewder things I heard after this election came from that great follower of Republican politics, Marilyn Katz, who did a column saying that she knew that Donald Trump was going to win the day that Nabisco laid off a bunch of factory workers on the southwest side of Chicago, and Donald Trump got all excited about it and put out a big statement. Hillary Clinton didn't say one word. Well, when the Democratic Party has no connections to working class factory folks, who are they? They got to figure this out, and they got to figure it out fast. They do have an advantage. I don't want to underestimate just how badly the Democratic Party has been shellacked. It's not so much what happened at the national level. It's what's happened at the state level. You got to start and work your way up. They don't have state houses anymore. They don't have governorships anymore. They still have city halls, but I wouldn't be surprised to see if that starts changing not too far down the road. But I don't want to overstate, because we, the media, always overstate. I don't want to overstate the degree of Trump's win. If you could change 250,000 votes in Florida, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, Hillary Clinton would have won the Electoral College in a landslide. She's going to win the popular vote probably by something north of 2 million votes. That's a place to start if you're the Democrats. But you got to have a message. You got to know what you're going to do. And there's kind of going to be a big fight between the Bernie Sanders wing and the Elizabeth Warren wing and what I'll kind of call the Tim Kaine wing. Here in Illinois, the Democrats are still on top, but I think you see lots of signs that the noose is starting to tighten around Mike Madigan. That ought to please the folks at the Tribune, at least their editorial page. Yes, the five seats that the Democrats won in the House were mostly in downstate areas, but those are still Democratic seats they've been able to hang on to for a long time. If the Republicans now can figure out a way to crack into the suburbs and take some of those seats away, because that's kind of natural Republican territory too, guess what? All of a sudden the House margin becomes really close. I think equally important, every single member of the House now knows what could happen to them at the next election, because they saw all their buddies slimed with millions and millions of dollars of TV ads. That could happen to any member now of the Democratic caucus in the House, and they know it. And if you don't think that's going to make some people nervous and may increase the pressure on the speaker to maybe cut a deal, sure it is. So is the labor decision yesterday that potentially puts AFSCME, the state's largest union, in a position of having to either cave into Bruce Rauner or walk out and go on strike. We're a few months in that, but it may be headed that way, and that too plays into politics. What the Democrats really need, and Natasha is absolutely right, is a candidate, and Lynn is right, is they need a candidate to run for governor. They don't have one yet. It's not going to be Dick Durbin, but the search is on. Two other thoughts I just leave you with. One is, I said this, I don't want to go through another election cycle like this. The degree of difficulty in uniting this country after this election is just staggering. I mean, only yesterday, a mayor, elected mayor from a town in West Virginia, was joking online about how it's going to be great to have a real first lady now and not an ape in heels.
Jesus.
That really happened. And this is America. It's 2016. I think it's 2016 or is it 1816? Two, it's a little town in West Virginia. I can't tell you offhand. Google it. Ape in heels. Two, I leave you with Heinz's rule about politics. Whenever you give any group of politicians a lot of rope, and the Republicans in Washington now own all of the rope, invariably, it may take a little while, but invariably, they tie it around their neck and junk. So it'll change.
Thank you, Greg. And Darlene Glanton of the Tribune. Darlene.
Hi. This is my first time here, and I'm very happy to be here. So thank you all for coming. If any of you have read my columns, you know that I was a big Hillary Clinton supporter. And I also like to write a lot about race and politics. And I think one of the things that we have to really think about going forward in this country is how much of a role race plays in the day-to-day lives of the people that we sometimes come in contact with and sometimes and quite often we don't. I can't say that I was shocked that Donald Trump would win this election. I certainly was hoping that he would not. But every time I write a column about race or about violence in this city, about Hillary Clinton or the Obamas, I get tons of emails and letters from people who just can't stand the idea of the fact that these are things that we need to talk about in our newspaper and in our, you know, in our society. So it wasn't really that much of a surprise to me when we found that there were lots of people who had an issue with that. I think there are a lot of reasons Hillary Clinton lost this election. One of them, of course, was that people wanted change. There is a large segment of the population who has suffered silently, economically, for a very long time. And while we boasted about the economy getting better for most of us, that didn't happen for everybody. And we seem to have forgotten that those people exist. Another thing, of course, is that Republicans came home because they felt as though things like Supreme Court justice appointments, the direction the country was going, and other things like that were more important than perhaps the divisive message that Trump was delivering. But if we're going to talk honestly about what happened in this election, We can't ignore the fact that race played a big part of this. I think I'm someone who grew up in the South, so I'm very familiar with a lot of things that are Southern, if you want to call it that. And I do believe that there were lots of people in rural areas throughout the country, in the Midwest, in the South, and on other areas that went for Trump, who have been angry for 8 years that we had an African-American president in the White House. And I do believe that they saw Trump as someone who could finally speak for them. And this is a difficult thing to talk about. We don't like to talk about these things. They make us very uncomfortable. But I think our country is in a crisis right now. And if we can't talk honestly about some of the things that are happening here, we'll never be able to move forward. One of Trump's biggest challenges, I believe, it will be to bring this country together. And that's really hard. That's a big challenge for someone who half the country loathes. And I, quite frankly, I don't know that he can. He hasn't shown any indication that he can. He says that now he's willing to do it, but he's done a lot of damage in this country, and there's a lot that needs to be repaired. So it'll be interesting going forward, and I hope that what happened during this election will allow us to just step back, take a look at what's really going on in this country, and make a concerted effort together to address these issues and try to find solutions.
Thank you, Darlene. Wonderful. Great. Okay, so now we have time for questions. Keep them coming. We'll try to answer as many as we can. This is from Michael Bauer, City Club member sitting over here. What does the election mean for President Obama's legacy? Who would like to comment on that? Lynn?
It's not good news for the legacy because a lot of it is now in jeopardy. Affordable Care Act, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is dead, the Paris Peace Climate Deal will probably become unraveled, the executive orders covering Dreamers, the parents of Dreamers, could be lifted with the stroke of a pen. What's interesting is when I listened to President Obama when he gave his press conference on Friday? 2 days ago. The days merged together. He is intent on doing a smooth transition because it's the right thing to do. But also I think he sees an opportunity to mitigate some of the reverses that Trump says he wants to do. And we know that because Trump, in his 60-minute interview on Sunday night, already said that he wants to keep the provision whereby everyone could get insurance that has pre-existing conditions, plus having kids under 26 stay in their parents' policy. Now, as a quick aside, everyone knows that keeping healthy, you know, all insurance companies welcome healthy people who never get sick. So that's not hard for policies in the private market to offer, but you can't just guarantee the insurance needs of the sickest without having a system. That system became Obamacare. So it may not all be undone as fast in some ways as President-elect Trump may think, because you still have Democrats in the House, and the way the rules are in the House, even a minority member can obstruct. So in short, there are a lot of regulations that have a lot of impact, such as fuel emission standards. They came to the regulatory route. The Republicans already are looking, Mike, as to how they can revoke them. Meanwhile, some of the other mega achievements that we won't be undone, such as the economy that was going in a tailspin in 08, is not today. Unemployment is down. But when I say the economy, and this speaks to one of the threshold issues in the election, and that is though the numbers are better. Obama is leaving at a time where unemployment is at 5. When he was running against Mitt Romney in 2012, when those numbers came out on the first Friday of every month, if they were 8, it would have been, or below, it would have been a great achievement. So the economy is better. The stock market is doing well. Everyone has not shared in the improvement, which created the political problem. But the car industry is back on its feet. So you have a lot of gains that happened on his watch, gay marriage, don't ask, don't tell, women in the military advances. So some of it can be lifted in the stroke of a pen. Some of it a Republican Congress may act on. Others may take longer to unravel. And then there's a question mark, and this is the important thing. You have Republicans in the House and Senate who are ideological, and Trump probably is not, as Obama himself said. So we may have a disconnect between a president who wants to make a deal and ideologues who may not.
Yeah, I think
thank you.
I think Lynn is onto something when she suggests that Obama was kind of stroking the new president a little bit. And it goes back to my first point about we really don't know yet who Donald Trump is. I mean, Donald Trump, most of his life, was a New York businessman who got along with everybody, was a social liberal, invited the Clintons to his last wedding. And now all of a sudden he's the head of this party that makes cavemen look modern sometimes. Where is this going to end up? Clearly he's going to have to throw some pieces of red meat to his base. I mean, that's just axiomatic in politics. The most obvious one is absolutely TPP is dead, free trade is dead for a while. He's going to do something that looks like a wall. I hope he doesn't repeal the DREAM Act executive order, but he may well. On the other hand, repealing Obamacare sounds great, but it runs into a lot of practical economic realities. If you're going to keep things that cost money, like pre-existing conditions and keeping the kids on their parents' policy up to 25, you're going to have to pay for it somehow. And Obamacare had a whole bunch of subsidies to pay for that. The health insurance companies aren't going to do that on their own. Well, how's that going to work in the real world? No politician has been born that's going to literally throw 20 million people off insurance tomorrow. They're talking about high-risk pools and tax credits and whatever, but how that's going to work in reality, I think, is quite questionable. So it's kind of going to depend on the issue here.
Thank you. Natasha or Darlene, do you want to make a quick comment on that before we move along?
Yes. I'd just like to say, you know, one of the things, I think Greg is exactly right. We don't know who Donald Trump is, and we don't know which side of the line he's going to actually fall on. But I'm actually hoping, since we're stuck with this, that he can find some way to work with Paul Ryan, and because there are some things that need to be fixed. Obamacare is one of them. The premiums are going through the roof for a lot of people, and these are things that have to be addressed. So I'm actually hoping that he can actually get something done with this. I'm not sure Hillary Clinton could have really done that. I'm not sure she could have saved it the way she wanted to. But that, and we also know that we need immigration reform in this country. It might not be in the form that all of us are happy with in the end, but something needs to be done. So I'm wishing him well on that.
May I just jump in? Oh, I'm so sorry.
One second.
No, I'm good.
You're good? I'd like to move along. We have so many questions, right. Lynn. Can we please? Thank you very much.
This is just a news flash, how Obama is trying to get a lot of things done before he finishes. On November 22nd at the White House, Newt Minow and Michael Jordan will be among the people who get the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And I know a lot of people here know Newt. So you can see he is trying to get everybody in by the end.
Okay. So we've got an interesting mix of questions here about the national issues and local or state issues. So this is a state question. Linda Foreman, where are you, Linda? Right over there. Great. Madigan didn't get the message from the voters that they've had it. How do you get him to move rather than form another committee? City Club, what do you expect?
How do you get them to move? Well, I think some of the things that we're seeing, some of the developments now that we're seeing are very interesting, and that is members sort of rising up and saying, maybe we need to question the speakership. Maybe it's not just a given. Maybe we need to demand from him something. Where's our message? What's our platform? Okay, we can't just be against what Rauner wants. What do we want? And I think to the extent that members are a little more empowered, and I think they certainly are now, given just the dynamics that are going on, I think that puts pressure on them. But, you know, the other thing that's really interesting that's happening is, you know, and I've written about this in the past, is, you know, what's happening with Bruce Rauner? Well, he's kind of becoming like a Madigan, right? I mean, he, like all these Republicans are falling in line behind Rauner. It's boss Rauner now. He has the money. Are you going to go against him like Sam McCann? Because, you know, they're going to fight tooth and nail against you. Are you scared of Madigan? Well, you better do what I say because I have the money, right? He's a powerful guy. And as Greg was talking about earlier, these campaigns were so nasty, you know, child molester. I mean, whatever the bottom is, that's where they went. And, the amount of money that's being spent on these elections just means that each side is just running into the arms of their leader who has the money. So it's going to be difficult, and I think it's interesting to see what's going to happen on the other side of the aisle as well.
Thank you, Natasha. Greg?
Listen, there clearly is a deal to be done here if both sides want to do a deal. But there's reasons to think that neither side really does. Rauner started off by presenting the wish list of wish lists. His first speech, I think, made reference to the legislature, made reference to something like 9 different constitutional amendments, and went from there. If he could get some workers' comp reforms, some limits on prevailing wage in public contracts or whatever, and a few other little things of that nature, that ought to be enough to declare victory for him and go ahead with the tax increase that we all know is needed. But I'm not sure he's willing to do that when he talks about stuff like term limits or a complete property tax cap. Those go right to whether unions have a place in Illinois, and trying to completely change the nature of the political system, and that's probably too much when you have a budget that I saw a story today that if they don't do something, Illinois could have $40 billion of IOUs in 3 or 4 years. And that's happening on his watch. He's a Republican businessman. Anyone know that that's not good? On the other hand, Madigan, although he's been pilloried personally by the governor and slammed, and his face appeared in, I don't know, how many hundreds of TV ads did we all see of the pictures of Mean Mike Madigan? He's a professional politician, for God's sake. Get over it.
Okay,
the election's done.
Thanks, Greg. Darlene, did you have a comment?
No.
Okay. A little different kind of question. This is from, I know we have 2 former state senators here. We always like to introduce them. Senator Art Berman over here on my right. And this question is from former Senator Billy Maravitz. Do you think the Secret Service will take away Trump's cell phone so he can't tweet? Hey, we need a little lighter question. And do you think the immediate Trump family will live in the White House?
Well, the Secret Service does not have the power to tell the president what to do. And there have been some reports on a serious note about living in the White House that Trump may be spending a lot of time in his New York City home in Trump Tower. So this certainly will be different. One thing to watch, by the way, in the inaugural parade, it will pass right by his new Trump Hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue.
Oh, very good. Okay, this is from Dave Cohn, who represents one of our sister organizations, the Union League Club of Chicago. President-elect Trump faces a serious challenge in dealing with the, quote, corrupt, lying, dishonest, end quote, news media. Do you have any advice for him? Darlene, you want to comment on that? Don't forget, Dold is sitting right here.
Well, listen, the more you challenge the media, the more they are going to go after you. So he should have learned that from, you know, the campaign. Look, I think that if he doesn't understand the importance of the media in getting his message out and doing what needs to be done to get things passed, then shame on him. I mean, he can't do this without the media. So he's going to have to just really figure out a way to follow, you know, swallow his pride and you know, let us in. You know, I mean, that's the reality of it. If not, the entire country, the country suffers from that, right? I mean, it's up to us to let you guys know what's going on. And if, you know, he's going to have to allow us to do our jobs.
I'm going to dissent from that a little bit. One of the things that Trump did is tap very successfully into social media. And I don't think any of us really quite yet understand how influential and how deep into all of our lives that has sunk. If he sees a story that the New York Times writes about him that's not very nice, he can tweet out to 20 million people right away his version of things. That's a going around the media ability that didn't exist before, and I wouldn't underestimate it.
Here are some of the things to watch for as we're in uncharted territory. Remember what I said, there's a no normal way of doing things. Whatever was the past is the past. So watch for whether or not whoever is the press secretary does daily briefings. That's been happening for quite a number of years now. Watch to see if these briefings are on television. Watch to see if he does a press conference soon. These are all the types of things that will start telling you what he wants to do, and then if he's at a press conference, if he takes questions. So I think we have no reason to think that the governing part will all of a sudden snap into place so that we get a replica of how press relations were. And this is a tough time for the press because the press, along with pollsters, didn't give an accurate picture in the end nationally of what was happening. And the president has an enormous bully pulpit, and with many alternative news organizations, half news organizations, opinion organizations that kind of look like news organizations, we have a lot of voices to be heard. And, you know, we're here. We're the mainstream media of Chicago outlets, and I appreciate very much that we are here. But when it comes to the Trump presidency, we will have some clues early on if at least there will be the, in dealing with the media that he doesn't like, if his people even want to have any of the trappings of how the White House worked. There is no reason to think that a past practice informs the future.
Great. Natasha?
Yeah, can I just add to that? One of my favorite quotes, and I'm sure a lot of people saw this, right after the election was, the media took Trump literally, but not seriously. Trump supporters took him seriously, but not literally. And I just thought that was so telling. I mean, how many times did you turn on, you know, Fox or CNN or any of those, and everyone's going around and around and around about, you know, something he said or something that was, you know, just not necessarily related to policy or to some of the more serious issues we need. And, you know, you'd talk to a Trump supporter and say, well, how can you support him when he said X, Y, and Z? And the response is always, well, he doesn't really mean that. He was just saying that, you know. He got a pass from a lot of these people. So I think there's going to be a come to Jesus moment from both sides. That's one thing. And the other thing I'll say is just from Politico, I mean, they flew everybody, all of the reporters from around the country last week. And, you know, we talked a lot about this. And, you know, I think our mandate is, I mean, I think our roles in society are more important than ever. I think that, you know, we just have to be fair, we have to be aggressive, and we have to do our jobs like never before. And we would do the same thing for a Hillary Clinton. But you can't engage in pettiness, you can't engage in these side fights. You just got to do our jobs. And I think in the end, people will appreciate that.
Thank you. Greg, this is for you specifically. From table 15, but they didn't put their name on. What is your take on the Exelon Energy deal now up for review in Springfield?
Oh, you're asking me something that I don't know a lot about, so I'm going to have to more or less pass. I'll just tell you a little bit. I mean, Exelon is clearly looking for a good deal. They have a lot of lobbyists. They have a lot of friends. People on the other side say it's not a good deal. I haven't looked at it in detail, so I can't tell you.
This is from Sharon Alter. To what extent do you think that there will be divisions and divisiveness among the Republicans in the House and Senate in their relations with President Trump? The real crystal ball question. Who would like to touch on that?
Well, I
Natasha.
Mean, sure. I mean, obviously, look at the primary, right? We had 17 Republicans. I mean, you talk about the media not predicting it. Well, think back at that time. I mean, one of the lead people who was really against Trump in Illinois was the former Republican Party chair here. The people who were calling him a clown were fellow Republicans. You know, a lot of them have come back. I mean, you saw Trump win over, you know, Ben Carson and Chris Christie and some others, after all those, you know, mudfests in all the different debates and stuff. But, there's still a lot of people who, I mean, look, the Republican Party has a lot of issues, as does the Democratic Party. And as Lynn was saying earlier, I mean, there's ideologues out there who are just not going to get along, or they're going to want something, and I think there's going to be a lot of fights.
I think one clear example of that is the fact that he's chosen Steve Bannon already as his, you know, top White House strategist. I can't imagine that any of the Republican establishment wants to deal with that. I also think that it depends on who Trump is going to be listening to. I don't necessarily think he's going to be listening to Mike Pence, who I think the Republicans would like to, you know, be in charge. There's actually also been some rumors out there which, you know, are based on nothing, that Trump may end up getting impeached by his own Republican Congress so that Mike Pence can take over. That would be interesting. So I don't think anybody's looking forward to working with Donald Trump. Not really. No.
Any of our other respondents want to comment on that?
I just want to add Mike Pence. I mean, I think that Trump has given him a lot of power, and he sees the benefit of having a Reince Priebus involved. He sees the benefit of having Pence. Pence can speak the language on Congress. He does want that. At least he's showing that right now. Obviously, all these things can change. But, you know, Pence was influential during the campaign. He was one of the people who, you know, was a big backer of going to Mexico. And he was, you know, he's also now he's the head of the transition team. And I think that is saying something. And I think that is calming some people down over the whole Bannon issue.
I'll add one bit to this. Don't just look at domestic stuff. If there's going to be a real crisis that explodes up, I think it's going to be on the international side. What happens if he tears up the Iran nuclear deal? What happens if he unilaterally cancels NAFTA? What happens if he makes it clear to Putin that, you can have the Ukraine and want some other stuff, go ahead. Or what if he pulls away our support from the Syrian rebels to give Putin a free hand in the name of beating ISIS? I mean, there are some things there that could really just blow up dramatically and immediately and have lots of implications. I don't watch for that.
Thank you, Greg. I want to take a moment to recognize a good friend of the City Club, former Republican member of our legislature, Tom Cross. Tom? This question is from City Club member Carlos Ponce. The electoral county-by-county map is a sea of red, particularly in the upper Midwest. Is Illinois the center for the resistance, or is it Custer's last stand?
May I take that?
Absolutely.
Right. And I just want to talk about, in the context, too, of another change that we don't have here in our Senate seat, and we have Mark Kirk's campaign manager here and one of the deputies. So I know you fought the good fight, and there's change coming. But, you know, Mark Kirk did serve for many years as a House member and a member of the Senate. And I think his brand of moderate Republicanism is something that very much doesn't exist very much at all in anymore. And he fought a tough fight. And I want to give a tip of the hat to your work and to the transition we're in now with Tammy Duckworth. And if we are in a test tube in Illinois, I think it will unfold in how the governor's race gets organized, if there's mobilized, and in the mayor's race. But here is the reckoning we need to come to first. If you are talking about a Democratic resurgence, is that Democratic turnout dropped? And so many of you here who are political operatives or consultants or activists or donors, you need a little bit of soul searching here as to what happened. And I think when you know the answers to that and you know what gets people jazzed up, when you know and look at most closely where your opportunities are, which in the map of Illinois, when I looked, are in the college campus towns outside of Illinois and the collars, I think you have kind of a sense of where to go. Also, I think the economy of Illinois is different for all the, you know, we're not Michigan, and we haven't suffered like that. I think the story in Wisconsin is different. It may be that there just wasn't enough. I think the dynamics there are a little different. Michigan, in a sense, you could have seen coming. And I'm not talking about whether or not the Hillary Clinton campaign made enough visits or not. So, Ed, I kind of put it out there. We'll know pretty soon if there is a resistance. We have a state party chairman, Mike Madigan, who doesn't function as a party chairman. He just protects his House majority. So you have a lot of potential in Illinois to, in a sense, start the new chapter because you have a base. As I mentioned before, it started with the activists who got involved in the Chuy Garcia campaign, transformed into the Sanders campaign. National Nurses United here is a force. And you look at some of the other organizing entities that aren't as well known, and you have something to work with.
Another question. Thanks, Lynn. Is if Hillary Clinton wasn't the candidate, but Bernie Sanders was, would the results, in your opinions, have been any different than they were?
Boy, that's the one that the Democratic Party is going to fight about for the next 2 years. My hunch is probably not, but honestly, I don't know. The problem with American elections now, and one of the problems the pollsters had, is not what the majority of the people think, but what a majority of the people who actually turn out to vote think. Elections are all now about getting your little faction all revved up, more revved up than the other little factions on the other side. And Sanders clearly, among younger people and among some labor activists, had a poll that would have ginned up that turnout. On the other hand, with suburban women who are with Hillary for a variety of reasons, would he have had that same kind of poll? Not necessarily. You know, it's the downside of the fact that even in presidential races now, most of us who are eligible to vote don't. You get down to local races. I mean, people talk about Chicago school board election. Electing the school board is coming up again in Springfield. You know, what happens when only 10% of the people of the city turn out? Who's going to run the board of education? It's a question of who votes.
Darlene?
And I think it depends on why you think Trump won. I mean, do you think he won with the vote for him, an anti-Hillary vote? I don't think so. I think people voted for Trump because they liked what he brought to the table. And I don't think Bernie Sanders could have changed that. The other thing is I also think that Hillary, I mean, it may have been a better ticket if Hillary had made Bernie Sanders her running mate, and then at least she would have had more of the younger people, perhaps, coming onto her side. Whether that would have been a good ticket, I don't know, but that's certainly something to think about. But I do think that people voted for Trump because they liked what he was saying. I don't think it had a lot to do with Hillary Clinton. If you look at white women, for example, they voted 53% for Trump. So, you know, what does that tell you?
Well, can Natasha? I just interject one thing? A couple things. One, fewer people voted for, yes, Democrats did not come out. She did not motivate her voters. We knew that from the beginning, right? I mean, there was talk about that a lot. Bernie Sanders almost beat her, yes. So in the end, she got fewer votes than Obama did by far. But Trump got fewer votes than Romney did. So, I mean, it was a turnout issue for sure. And it was a lot of Democrats did not show up. And one thing we haven't talked about is this whole Comey effect, which I do think played a role in. I mean, here you have the director of the FBI, and I'm looking at Randy Sanborn right now, and I'm sure if you were there, you would have been yelling at him. But, I mean, you know, I covered the Bureau and the Justice Department for years, and they take great pains to not involve themselves in elections. Look, the Verdoliak indictment was held for a week, for God's sake. Like, what is that? What was that going to affect? I don't know. Aaron Schock, arguably, was delayed a little after the election, came out the day after. But then you have the director of the FBI inserting himself when he did. I'm not saying that he was trying to throw the election or anything. I don't think it was ill will, but I do think that it had an effect. I mean, so she ends up, I mean, if you think about the time when things really shifted, the Access Hollywood tape comes out, right? All these women start coming out and saying he sexually assaulted me, and we're going through all that. His numbers were bottoming, such as they were, you know, his numbers were bottoming out. There are a lot of Trump supporters, and I don't know if I'm unique in this, but I happen to, they surround me. They were just giving up on him. They're like, this guy, you know, he's got too many issues. Hillary, she's stable, she's, you know. And then all of a sudden this FBI thing comes out, and that resurrected a lot of bad feelings. So when she was at the point where she could have really picked up the momentum, that just stopped her. She ended up with, it ended on a bad message. And yes, he came back the Sunday before, but that was almost worse. I mean, because now, you know, oh, guess what? We looked through all the emails, all the tens of thousands of emails, and she's fine. Just so kidding. So people who thought it was all cooked, just it played into that.
Does the panel think that Trump will remove Mr. Comey from office? And
well,
the other question tied into that that someone
asked.
He
has a 10-year appointment.
The U.S. attorney here in Illinois, Zach Fardin. Do you expect him to be removed, and what sort of person to replace him?
Well, there's a few, actually, predicates. I would expect that one way or the other, the word will get to the U.S. attorneys to submit their resignations. The White House chief of staff already asked the White House staff to do that. Then when it comes to Illinois, we have to figure out who, if Trump continues the tradition of getting input from local leaders, and I am, you know, I think all bets are off. We don't have. I have an enormous compliment to how Senator Kirk and Senator Durbin worked together in a agreement for the appointment of federal officials in these past years. Again, it is a tribute to what they accomplished together, and it's. Different now because we have to figure out, one, what does the Trump White House want to do if they care? Now, the senior Republican in Illinois right now in the delegation is John Shimkus. I would imagine there will be a consultation with Governor Rauner, perhaps. So we have a work in progress as who will speak for the Illinois congressional delegation to the White House. there may or may not be some kind of appointment sharing agreement that continues with the Democrats, so that 4 years from now, you always can, if the White House changes hands, you have a chance of getting some of your guys in. By the way, when I talk about the Kirk-Durbin agreement, the motivation for both people on it was that even if Kirk got maybe only one, you had to reach consensus, and it's kind of like your guy had the advantage, whatever their formula was, you know, 1 in 3 or 1 in 4. It meant that Senate confirmation is possible. It meant that a Democratic, see, we're talking about Senate confirmable positions. One Democratic senator could hold up everything. So do you see in the appointments here, there is a dynamic that that encourages consensus if the local leaders want it, and if that's what the president wanted.
One aside, I know Greg wanted to respond.
Just one aside off of that real quick. Lynn mentioned Bruce Brown, and we should probably talk about that for a minute. Normally, you would think Republican president, Republican governor, everything's hunky dory. Bruce Brown went out of his way to snub Donald Trump. He's gone out of his way even since the election to snub Donald Trump. There's very few people who work for Rauner who are tight with Trump. The one obvious go-between is Ron Gidwitz, a big fundraiser who's close to the governor and was in Trump's inner circle to the extent anybody was in Illinois. But I don't know how far that goes. For any number of reasons, getting financial aid, U.S. attorneys, whatever, you would think there'd be a line of communication set up soon between the chief executive of the state and the chief executive of the country. I don't know that's going to happen because clearly this governor's first priority is getting himself reelected. And my guess is he wants to see whether Trump is going to succeed or trip on himself before he makes a move.
Natasha and Darlene, do you have a comment on that? And then we have time for one last question.
Yeah, I would just add quickly that that Pence's top strategist was also Bruce Rauner's top strategist, and that was Nick Ayers. And so there are, you know, to the extent that that's influential, I think there that and Pence was, of course, at Rauner's inauguration here. So there is some, lines of communication there and a positive history, at least with the vice president, which is a pretty good place to be.
Darlene, any comment? Okay. I think we have one last question here. I'm trying to meld some of these questions. Jeff Gordon from Duff and Phelps. If you had to pick who will be the Democratic candidate for governor in 2018, assuming that Rauner's going to run for reelection as Governor Rauner, as Greg said, and who will be the leading Democratic candidate for the presidency in 2020, assuming that Donald Trump will run for reelection? So quickly, we'll call it the lightning round. Give us a few names. Stump the panel.
Sherry Bustos could be an interesting pick because she's got the downstate stuff and she's Congresswoman.
Congresswoman from the Rock Island area.
Her name's been, and obviously there's lots of state lawmakers who, Andy Menar and so forth. J.B. Pritzker was, Shea Kappos wrote about that today, that he, could may or may not. Chris Kennedy's name's been up. I don't want to take them all. But I think the main concern from Democrats now is we need somebody with money. It doesn't have to match one-to-one, but they need somebody who has a larger pool of funds. I'll pass it on.
Greg, Darlene.
You could add a couple more names to that, but they don't have money. Mike Furyk's the state treasurer, but that's the Democratic problem at the state level. They don't have a good candidate right now. They're looking. We'll see if they come up with somebody. At the national level, I think you'll see somebody out of the Bernie Sanders wing. Maybe not Bernie, maybe Elizabeth Warren. She's the obvious one, the senator from Massachusetts. And then I think you'll see somebody from the quote-unquote moderate ring, somebody like Tim Kaine, the senator from Virginia, who did a pretty good job running for vice president.
Darlene?
Well, I don't know about statewide, but I would just say nationally, I think they need to find somebody young. I think the Democratic Party just looks a bit too old. for the times we live in.
Thank you. One last question. Do you anticipate, if Speaker Madigan were to step down, do you think the Attorney General would run for governor in 2018?
I don't buy your premise.
Okay. I don't buy it either, but I just thought I would ask. Latrice, if you come up here, please. Let's thank our panel.